Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening and viewing audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Veena Srinivasan. Dr. Veena Srinivasan, PhD, is a research associate at the Pacific Institute. Her research focuses on understanding the feasibility of multiple-use services, developing water systems that serve both domestic and livelihood water needs in rural communities. Veena's interests include water resources sustainability, the study of urbanization, impacts of urbanization, and land use change on water resources, and the study of coupled human-natural resources systems. Her dissertation research explored the role of urban groundwater in the Indian city of Chennai. Veena's postdoctoral work has involved creating a framework to understand and study the nature of water crisis globally in support of a global freshwater initiative at Stanford University, where Veena was a postdoctoral scholar at the Utz Institute of the Environment and received her doctoral degree from the IMET Interdisciplinary Program in Environment and Resources. Prior to her doctoral studies, Veena worked for several years in private and non-profit sectors examining energy, water, and forest conservation policies in India and the United States. She has a bachelor's degree from the India Institute of Technology, Bombay, and a master's degree in energy and environmental analysis from Boston University. Please join me in welcoming Veena Srinivasan.
Thank you all for coming this evening. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Chisako, for giving me this opportunity to talk about a subject that I'm interested in, and I'm glad to see that so many other people are interested in it as well. I'm going to talk about the talk today is called Pipe Dreams, Water for Thirsty Cities. And I'm going to be talking about the challenge of growing urbanization in India and the fact that water is going to be one of the big challenges while that economic growth and urbanization that goes along with it happens. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the challenge and describe the nature of the problems that and the very steep challenge in front of India's cities, and then try to analyze that and walk you through a narrative of what causes those problems, and then hopefully end on a slightly more positive note by looking at some possible solution pathways to addressing that very major challenge that India's cities face. So let me talk about the type of the nature of the challenge to start with. And the first big problem is that diarrhea remains the leading cause of childhood mortality among children in India. And it's true that a lot of that mortality remains is mostly in rural areas, but even in urban areas today, there are very high diarrheal rates among children in slums. The second problem is the daily struggle for water. And if you went to some of the Indian cities where, the slums in Indian cities, you might see a scene where you have these jostling crowds crowding around a water source. And this story here mentions a family that was actually killed in standing for a water line not too long ago, just 2 years ago, in the Indian city of Bhopal. Jeevan Malviya, his wife Savita, and son Raju were killed by neighbors when standing in line because they tried to jump the water supply line. And the third type of problem that I want to be thinking about is the water crisis that threaten to the very stability of India as a country. When the Kaveri water judgment was passed, and the Kaveri is a very contentious river that's shared between two southern states, Tamil Nadu and Karnataka, and when the judgment, which dictated how the water was to be shared between those two states, was passed in 1991, riots broke out, and 20 people were killed, and 15,000 were rendered homeless in the riots that followed that. And this problem 20 might seem a small number in a million, but this problem kind of has recurred over the years, over and over again. And as recently as 2009, the entire city of Bangalore, which you might have heard as being the IT capital of India, was shut down because activists protested the raising of a statue, a Tamil poet, which was a poet from the other state in Bangalore. And so even though the underlying problem is the sharing of a river, it's kind of crept into the cultural dialogue between each of these cities. And the riots have kind of recurred over and over several years in the last 20 years. And this threatens, if every state kind of starts saying that our water is our water and we're not going to share it, it threatens the very stability of India as a country. So let's talk about cities specifically and focus on the particular piece of the problem that I'm going to be talking about today, which is urban water. Now, urbanization is the inevitable pathway that every city in the world has to follow as economic growth happens. If you look at the percentage of the population of any country in the world that lives in an urban area, you'll find that that's kind of increased. And most developing countries kind of cluster around the 85-90%. India and China are still way down there at the 20-35%. But every projection shows that as these countries develop, they're going to reach the 85-90%. So while it took about 40 years for the first 250 million people to reach Indian cities, it's only going to take another 20 years for the next 250 million people to get into Indian cities. So it's a massive number of people. We're talking about an entire United States moving into Indian cities in the next 20 years. Now, clearly, that's a major challenge. Not only that, this kind of shows you the distribution, the global distribution of megacities. Megacities are cities with 10 million or more people. And when you just look at where the next new megacities are going to be, so the cities that will become megacities by 2035, you'll see this heavy concentration in India and China. But just look at India and how small it is and how many megacities it's going to have. So clearly, that's going to be a big problem. Now, cities are very, very important places. They're kind of the drivers of the new Indian economy. So this projection, this is from the McKinsey Global Institute, says by 2030, India is going to have 570 million people. And right now, that number is about 300. So we're going to have 270 million additional people moving into cities or being born there. And it's going to account for 70% of new jobs created, 70% of GDP. Right now it's about 58%. And 85% of the tax revenue is going to be from cities. So clearly cities are important places. What happens to cities dictates what happens to the economy of the country. The big concern, however, is that cities need concentrated services. And you need to have water supply, you need to have sewerage, you need to have electricity, you need to have solid waste management, all of that working for cities to be able to thrive. Now, the McKinsey Global Institute estimates that the demand-supply gap, so how much is needed versus how much is being supplied, is going to widen for both water supply and sewerage services, almost double in just the next 20 years by 2030. And that's a big, big challenge. They estimate that it's about $1.2 trillion of investment that's needed in Indian urban areas just to meet all of those different services. Now, the problem is that when services are not being offered or being supplied at the rates they're needed, the urban poor suffer the most. The urban poor have few options to go out, and they can't go into a forest and get water from a lake. They're dependent on urban services being provided. The rich are able to cope by either buying private water, digging their own wells, figuring it out somehow, installing, ultraviolet purification systems. The urban rich can figure it out. The urban poor suffer the most. And if you look at how much the poor already pay for water in different parts of the world, and you look at how much pipe supply costs in New York in the United States versus a variety of countries where the urban poor must depend on informal supply from a variety of sources, the poor pay a lot more for water than the rich do. And that's kind of where the problem lies. So the challenge of urban water supply is really about getting good quality water at an affordable price where and when it's needed in a fashion that's sustainable, that's not going to impact future generations and their ability to thrive. Now, let's break that out into all the specific problems that Indian cities face. The first thing to remember is throughout this talk, I'm going to be talking about Indian cities and consumption of Indian cities, but the quantity of water that urban consumers use is far less on average compared to where the United States is. And there's a big variation among, you know, urban areas in the United States, but the point is that Indian cities are still way below that, more like around 80, 90, 100 liters per capita per day. The second thing is that supply is highly intermittent. Now, sadly, this is unique to the Indian subcontinent, so to India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. If you compare the largest cities of this is a comparison of Asian cities only now, and you'll find that 24/7, the fraction of households that have 24/7 pipe supply in their household in Indian cities is abysmally low. In fact, no Indian city has 24/7 water supply for all of its population, and it's hardly 10, 15, 20% of the population that has 24/7 water supply. And this is unique because the rest of Asia has obviously managed to figure this out. The second problem is that supply is highly inequitable. You might, if you go through one of the more affluent suburbs in Bangalore or Chennai or Bombay, the wealthier cities, you might see a gardener in front of one of those big apartments or fancy houses using a garden hose to water a very nice flower bed. And it's very likely that that very same gardener would go home and stand in line to collect water at her slum. And there's clearly something very wrong with this picture, that you have this feast and famine situation where within a few kilometers of each other, water is being used fairly wastefully versus there are some that have to stand for hours just to get their daily minimum quantity of supply. The other problem, and this is an example from the city of Madras, that water supply, pipe water supply, fluctuates very significantly. You don't find in San Francisco when you get up that you had good supply this June, but then you have none in October, and then you have a lot of water supply again in December, and then none in January. You don't see that kind of crazy fluctuation. And you do see that in Indian cities, and I'll talk a little bit about the reasons why you see this kind of crazy feast and famine, again, feast and famine across seasons. And finally, another thing that you see which is fairly unique to Indian cities is a high dependence of private wells in urban areas. It's virtually unheard of in any of the developing world for people in large cities like San Francisco and New York to have their own private well systems. Generally, most of the developing world has figured out how to supply pipe supply reasonably reliably at reasonably affordable rates, and that still hasn't happened. And this is just a listing of Indian cities and the fraction of households that continue to have their own private wells and get a significant fraction of their water from private wells. So the problem with having private wells is twofold. Firstly, cities tend to have groundwater which isn't safe. It's got all kinds of contaminants in it. But a bigger problem, even if you could figure out what to do with the contaminants, is that groundwater is disappearing fast. And if you look at a satellite image of India and where groundwater is, wherever you have deep aquifers, so wherever you have groundwater that can be depleted, it is being depleted. And in India, most of the deep aquifers are in the northern part, the northern belt of India, in the Indo-Gangetic Plain. That's where you kind of have deep alluvial aquifers. And you can just see groundwater levels are being depleted over time. And this is, if you looked at it's a stylized diagram of where groundwater levels in the capital of Delhi are going, and they've just been steadily falling over the last 20, 30 years. So what we've seen is that pipe supply, which is being supplied by the utility, is unreliable, and groundwater, which tends to be a backup source in Indian cities, which is also a unique situation, that's disappearing as well. So what does that tell us about the nature of the problem? So what I'm going to do is kind of walk you through the different pieces of the Indian water puzzle And we'll look at where the problem is and where how we might be able to kind of start thinking about solutions for them. So let me walk you through the urban water cycle. You have a water utility. In most cities in the world, you have a water utility. The water utility will go and put in a big transmission line and get water from some kind of a surface water system. Usually it's a river on which has been dammed, so you have a reservoir. And then the reservoir will release water every day, a certain amount of water, which will go to a water treatment plant in the water utility. And then that will be supplied through a pipe network to consumers. The utility might also get water from groundwater, as some parts of California in the Bay Area, for example, some of the South Bay gets groundwater. So a utility gets water from a water resource somewhere out there and treats it and supplies it through a pipe network to consumers. Consumers use the water in their house and they generate wastewater, which goes back to another water treatment plant, usually either a separate wastewater utility or the same water utility's wastewater treatment plant. The water will be treated to some quality, some reasonable standard, and then released back into the environment. And this is kind of the story in most cities in the world. What happens in India, as we said, is that utility supply is not very reliable, and consumers get water for a few hours a day maybe, or not at all, or it fluctuates greatly from year to year and season to season. So what consumers do is they adapt a whole variety of coping mechanisms to be able to get around this problem. And as I mentioned before, different people, different consumers have different abilities to cope. And so generally, this is a wealthier household, would then build this huge underground storage. So in the two-hour window where water is available in the pipelines, they would kind of get enough for their daily supply, which is why if some of you visited India and stayed, you know, in one of the bigger cities, you probably haven't noticed that India isn't getting 24/7 water supply, because if you haven't been the person that's opening the tap and finding that there's no water, because the water's been stored every morning in for the 2 hours that it is that the pipelines are pressurized. The water's stored in collected and stored in an underground sump, and it's pumped into an overhead tank on top of a house or a building, and then it flows by gravity into your tap. So the wealthier households actually, for most part, haven't noticed that India doesn't have 24/7 supply, because that's their story. The poorer households might either try, who can't afford to build this huge underground storage and overhead tank and or don't have the space to do it, might have one of these little pumps in their backyard. So if the water pressure isn't enough every morning, the woman of the house will go out with her bucket and she'll pump that little pump that she has in her backyard and collect water for her day and carry it into the kitchen and the bathroom for storage. Or she might have to walk to a common street standpipe and have to do the same thing and walk back to her home. But the point is that supply is not reliable and consumers figure out ways to adapt to the situation. The other thing that consumers do is they find, as I mentioned before, a variety of ways to cope, which involve commonly digging their own private wells. So if they're running out of water or it happens to be a year when rainfall's been a little low, consumers would then turn on their own private wells and start using that. And I want to kind of emphasize that that is a very unusual situation for urban areas. Even in the developing world, it's fairly unusual, but certainly by standards of this country, you don't see a lot of private wells in big cities. You might see them in, you know, rural settlements and so on. And so the problem is that if you look at this entire system, it's a fairly complex system, but to understand the nature of the Indian urban water crisis, you need to understand that the system's broken at many, many different levels, and really it requires all of those pieces to be fixed to really get to a functional system, which we are aspiring to. So firstly, let's look at the first piece of the problem, which is getting what I call the supply augmentation problem. But it really is the piece of the problem where the water utility needs to go out there and get water from ground and surface water sources. Now, the key thing to understand is that cities don't live within their water footprint. And by that I mean that a city is a high enough concentration of population where they can say that we're just going to manage with the rainfall that falls in this area. We're talking about 10 million people living in a very tiny, small, area of a few 50, 100 square kilometers. And so they really need to get water from distant sources. And getting water from distant sources is a complicated issue because it involves a whole variety of maneuvering, apart from the investment, which is one piece of it. But it really involves all kinds of political negotiation. So I'm going to tell you a couple of different stories. The picture there shows you a picture of the Sonia Vihar Dam, the Tehri Dam, which supplies New Delhi through a project called the Sonia Vihar Project. Now, in India, the problem is that the water supply is controlled by state governments and not the federal government. And which means that if you're a city that happens to get water supply, it's big water supply from a neighboring state, you have to negotiate with that state to get the water supply. Now, often in interstate projects, there is a way to do this. There's an interstate agreement which will say that, you know, state A gets X and state A gets B gets Y. But it's not clear that the states will abide by those agreements. If you are an upstream state and you have the ability to control that regulator, you're going to do everything you can in a year that water's running short to make sure you're not turning the regulator, turning that regulator on to release the water downstream. And this is kind of the same kind of political bargaining that you see over and over again. So in this case, the state of Delhi, which is also where the capital of India is located, had to get water from the Tehri Dam. And the state of Uttar Pradesh, which happened to be controlling the Tehri Dam, refused to turn the regulator on for a variety of reasons. They used that as a bargaining chip to get all kinds of other concessions that they need to get. So it's not a cut and dry thing that if you have constructed a water project, you're in fact going to get the water at the periods that you need it. The second kind of problem is the water might often be transported through a long interstate open canal like the picture in the middle. Now, what do you think is going to happen when you have a really big drought and farmers along that canal are suffering because they aren't able to irrigate their fields because it hasn't rained? Well, they're going to take a hose pipe and stick it in there and turn a pump on and pump water out of that canal. And that's what happens in all of these interstate canals. And if it's a 1,000-kilometer long canal, you can't police the entire 1,000 kilometers. So a lot of the water in these interstate canals is lost en route because of theft. Some of it leaks into the ground. Some of it's because of theft. Some of it is because state governments along the way will look the other direction and allow irrigation districts to officially siphon water off. But a variety of reasons might prevent the water from actually getting to where it needs to get. The third kind of problem is really almost terrorism / activism. And that is, again, an example of the Sonia Vihar project, which supplies Delhi. And here, it was a case where a bunch of activists wanted national attention for their particular cause that they were agitating for in that particular location. And they basically stormed the dam and took control of the regulator, and they just held back Delhi's water supply for 4 days, saying, if you don't give us attention, we're not going to let the water. And they had to call the police in, and that's a picture of the police patrolling the place. But it kind of tells you that when you get water from distant places, which all cities have to do, it's not a simple task to actually make sure that water gets to the city. Okay, the second kind of problem is uncontrolled demand. Now, as I mentioned, when a lot of, particularly on the engineering side, there's a tendency to think that everybody who lives in a city needs a certain amount of water to drink or to live or so on. But in fact, consumers do respond, and how consumers use water depends on how much they're being charged for the water. In most Indian cities, almost 50-60% of Indian cities, water is not even metered, let alone being charged on any kind of a cost recovery basis. That being the case, when water is available, consumers who are lucky enough to have access to it are going to use water wastefully because they have absolutely no incentive to cut back on how they use water. So you definitely see large cities, you see those gardening hoses, you see people, if they have a car, they might be washing it. You know, there's definitely no control over how consumers use water because there isn't any kind of price signal or any metering or even any information to tell people how much they're using. So the second piece of the problem is really how consumers respond to price signals, and really what is needed, you would want water to be charged in a way that you can use the pricing signal to kind of give consumers some sense of how precious the resource is, and that simply doesn't exist. The third type of problem is what I call the aging infrastructure problem. It's not different from what you might see in this country, but It's particularly acute in India, and for several reasons that I'll analyze in a minute. One of the things that you might see in this aging infrastructure is this is an extreme example of a broken pipeline, but it's very common to see very, very leaky pipelines. Indian cities are notorious for their high leakage rates. Cities like Delhi have almost 50-60%. People don't know the exact number because it hasn't been studied well enough, but it's 40-60% of the water that's being leaked out before it even gets to the consumer. So you take all the trouble to build that huge dam, put an interstate, that interstate pipeline, the regulator, treat the water, put it into the pipe system, and then 60% of it, it's gone before it ever gets to the consumer. So that's clearly a problem. But the reason that's been ascribed to this problem is what development analysts like to call the low-level equilibrium trap, which is a peculiar combination of really an outcome of the political system in India. But really what happens is consumers don't get water to start with. They have a very low service that they don't use much of the water. So there's very little revenue collection because the utilities don't get enough revenue from consumers. As a result, they don't invest in the infrastructure. And because they don't invest in the infrastructure is kind of leaky and doesn't deliver much. And because it doesn't deliver much, consumers don't get to use it. And you have this perpetual trap where people aren't willing to pay because they're not getting a service that they can rely on, but they don't get a service that they can rely on because they're not willing to pay. And so you really have this chicken and egg problem. And it's a hard one to break, especially when you have political leaders that are willing to exploit it and declare, free water for all at every election and kind of exploit that sentiment. The other piece of the problem is the lack of access problem. I mentioned earlier, I've kind of been talking and showing you pictures of nice big houses with pumps and bore wells, and that's clearly not what a large fraction of Indian city dwellers look like. A large fraction of Indian city dwellers don't have an in-house piped connection at all. They must either wait for the pipe utility, if they're lucky, to send one of these trucks and line up outside the truck and try to get it, or an even worse example, they might have to break into a pipeline and kind of stick their pipe in and try to get out water if they can. And that actually makes the leakage problem even worse, but that is, in fact, the reality of the situation. So for these people, the problem is not only having to go and get the water, but it's also the fighting for it, the daily fight for the water. It's also the uncertainty. Think about if you had to get a tanker, but you don't know exactly what time that tanker is going to come. You're going to spend half of your morning just hanging around waiting for that tanker to come. And it may come at 9 o'clock, it may come at 10 o'clock, but, just imagine how much of your daily wage is lost in just hanging around and waiting for it. And the final piece of the problem, actually not the final piece, but one more piece of the problem is what I'm going to call the groundwater governance problem. And as I mentioned, a large fraction of consumers actually have their own private wells, or they might buy water from these tanker suppliers that then go and get water from a well outside the city. But the problem is that there is a big groundwater governance problem. Groundwater in India legally is what's called open access, what in this country you would call open access, which means it belongs to the landowner, and if you happen to own a piece of land, you can take as much water out of it as you want. So legally, there's no barriers to how much water you can take. Now, different cities have tried to experiment with regulation, trying to say you can't dig deep wells deeper than a certain amount. You can't dig wells closer than a certain amount. But really, a private bore well looks like that. It's a really tiny structure. And it's really impossible if you have a city with 10 million people, which has 5 million of these little things. It's impossible for the water utility or any government official to go looking for them and find them. So even if you wanted to regulate groundwater, there's not really an easy way to do it because they're virtually undetectable. You'd have to change the laws, but assuming you could, it's still virtually undetectable. So the groundwater governance problem, and clearly this means that when consumers, industries, large buildings can afford to suck the groundwater out, that's what they're going to do. And that's why you have a groundwater crisis in Indian cities. And the final piece of it is the wastewater and sewage, sanitation and sewage problem. Now, I'm not going to be talking a lot about sanitation and sewage. It's an entire subject by itself, and I think it merits its own time. But there's clearly a big problem where I'm going to allude to it to the extent that it impacts water supply. When you have sanitation and sewage that's not being taken care of and you have these open sewers, the one big problem is that it contaminates existing water sources. So where you have the few urban ponds and lakes which you could use as potential water storage without having to build a lot of new dams, even those are lost because they've been completely contaminated. So the wastewater problem, to that extent, goes back and impacts your lack of water supply. Quite completely apart from the separate problem of disease and public health and mosquitoes and all the other problems that it causes. Okay. Let's try and kind of get a little more positive. I'm kind of hopeful, presumably by this time, depressed everybody. But as difficult as the problem is, and as big as the challenges are, there are better ways and worse ways to address the problem. And the first piece that I'm going to talk about is when you see those demand supply gap projections by places like the McKinsey Global Institute. They obscure the fact that the problem is as much about uncontrolled demand as it is about insufficient supply. And if you constantly focus on, we've got to augment supply, augment supply, augment supply, you have all of those other problems that we talked about. But really the first piece of it is being able to control demand in some fashion and then being able to get to a more reasonable level of consumption, a more equitable level of consumption, before you can then try and meet that lower standard. The second piece of it is that the really big crisis in Indian cities happen in bad rainfall years. So it's not a problem of average supply. It's a problem of supply in those years when you have these sudden drops. And that's a problem that has solutions, but it can be solved in some creative ways. Now, let me give you an example. The city of Chennai, which used to be called Madras in southern India, had a really big drought in 2003-2004. And one of the things they did in that year, because they couldn't actually get water from interstate projects for various reasons, of political reasons, what they did was go to farmers right outside the city and offer to pay them off in exchange for getting water on a short-term basis, just for the period of the drought. Now, this was really a win-win situation because it gave farmers some kind of a compensation. Normally, what would happen is that there would be a big riot in the city. The chief minister would go out and make a speech, and then they would just take the money from the farmers who might have already made investments in that year's crop and so on. But this kind of having these short-term markets or short-term transfers from agriculture to urban offers some kind of a stopgap solution where it allows farmers to be compensated. It also allows urban cities to be sure that in those periods when water is going to be really short, yes, it's going to cost them something, but they have some kind of an ability to get water for that period. It's a relatively new experiment. It's not, but it's certainly a possibility. It's one of the few that I can see could help. The third piece of it is trying to move away from this idea that cities always have to get all of their water from distant sources. There is a possibility of thinking about integrating more decentralized supply options into urban planning. And a lot of cities in India have been incorporating urban rainwater harvesting, which is basically that, you know, in the periods that it rains, you try to collect the rainwater and use it for, you know, you store it locally in your house for and try to use it for non-potable uses. This has the potential to say that instead of having all of your urban supply come from one centralized source, and it's that source which has to be completely reliable, you take some of the pressure off from having to build the next three new dams or the next four new transmission mains. And finally, inevitably, some new reservoir storage and dams will have to be built. But there are creative solutions even to deal with that. There's kind of, like I mentioned, a lot of urban ponds, a lot of urban lakes, peri-urban tanks which exist, which aren't being used as pieces of the urban supply system. And there is potential to integrate those better into the urban supply system. The second piece of it is the uncontrolled demand problem. Now, there's no way to get around this other than metering and charging for water. But environmental NGOs and, you know, the social NGOs in India have kind of shied away from pushing water pricing as being a piece of the message, particularly for the wealthiest households. Wealthiest households in India still pay very, very little for water compared to most other parts of the developed world. But it's not a message that is being promoted very widely among prominent Indian NGOs going to, you know, big wealthy buildings, wealthy households, and saying you ought to be paying, you know, for your share of the piece of water. The other piece that you don't see, which has already been done in California very successfully, is promoting water-saving technologies, which is, you know, low-flow meters, drip irrigated gardens, and so on. You see this in the developed world. It hasn't, as far as I can tell, made a big splash in the wealthier sections of the developing world. And that, if you have promoted those two messages together, saying, yes, you need to be paying more for water, but your water bill doesn't need to go up because there's really ways you can manage water better in the household, I think that could go a long way to kind of adjusting some of that inequity problem. The third piece of it is the aging infrastructure problem. Now, the aging infrastructure problem, you would think, is really about fixing pipelines and pipeline leaks and putting more pipes in. But I'm not going to focus on that piece of it, because actually water utilities, whether in India or anywhere else in the world, are incredibly good at putting pipes in. They know how to do that. The problem that really stops, that the underlying problem of the aging infrastructure issue, is really the financial health of water utilities. So and that's one piece, and corruption is the other piece. So there's two pieces why you really have an infrastructure problem. It's not because the engineers somehow don't know where to put the pipe. So I'm going to kind of look at solutions that look at the underlying cause rather than, just trying to put a fix on it. So a couple of different things have been tried by various cities in India, which I think are promising initiatives. The first picture is from the state of Andhra Pradesh, the city of Hyderabad, which started this one-stop consumer services cell. And if you remember that low-level equilibrium problem that I talked about, one of the reasons consumers aren't willing to pay is that they don't get any water. And they feel every time the government goes and puts a tariff hike that there are water prices just went up again, but we didn't get any better water service for that price hike. And the government thought that the one way to do that is, well, how about if we went about improving services to consumers so that consumers would kind of feel like they were being serviced better. We would have a more streamlined way of responding to complaints. But more importantly, rather than doing it in the traditional government way, we would kind of make sure that the consumer services cells are incentivized. So they have all kinds of these dashboards where they kind of allow the different areas to compete against each other. They kind of maintain statistics saying your area did really well in consumer responsiveness. They reward employees for consumer service. So do much more softer ways of recognizing consumer service, but it kind of ties into that bigger piece of making consumers then more willing to pay for the service in the first place. And the second piece of it is, I think, citizen empowerment efforts. And this, I would specifically say, aim towards the corruption piece of it. Now, clearly, India, like a lot of developing countries, there's a lot of corruption. A lot of the infrastructure doesn't go, or the money for infrastructure doesn't go where it's supposed to be. But I found a few citizen empowerment efforts that I felt were very promising. And this one was one from Chennai, which was a bunch of people that decided to put up this transparent Chennai website where they just created maps of, you know, where the toilets are, how many sewage lines there are, where the next bridges were coming up, a variety of other things, which allows consumers then to be more vigilant in their own neighborhoods rather than waiting completely for the government to fix itself. I mean, we would all like that to happen, but, you know, I think it helps to have initiatives like this that promote that. Now, the lack of access problem. As I mentioned, a lot of households don't have their own household connections. There's two separate categories of households that have that problem. The first category is what I call households which have regularized, they own the home, but they just don't have the money to go and get a water connection. Now, if for households like that, microfinance schemes have been shown to help, because a lot of these times the households have money to pay, but they don't have the lump sum that they have to pay upfront to go and get a water connection. And a lot of utilities have experimented with these microfinance schemes where they allow them to do an installment basis or some other kind of guarantee that they will pay for the connection over time, but that has been rolled into the water utility. And that, I think, works very well. A bigger and more challenging problem is when the settlement itself or the slum is an informal or an unauthorized settlement. In this case, oftentimes the government doesn't want to put the piped mains in there for a variety of reasons. The land might be illegally occupied, it might be unsafe to live, it might be a floodplain which gets flooded every year, and the government doesn't want squatters to be living there. So in this case, the government doesn't want to put the pipelines in, and perhaps in some of those cases it shouldn't put the pipelines in. But that doesn't mean that it's fair to not, you know, to allow people to not have any water. So this second example is from the city of Chennai, which I think works very well, where they set up this big storage tank kind of at the edge of the settlement or the corner of the street, and the tanker will go and deliver the water to that tank every day. And they allow the local community to figure out how they are going to manage that endowment of water for the day. And usually, when I've interviewed communities, they've been incredibly good at doing this because they'll know that this tank belongs to these 20 households. There'll be an old woman usually, who kind of happens to be sitting at home, and she'll make sure that none of the households takes more than they are allowed to take. But it solves a lot of the problems. It makes the water there for 24 hours, so they're not hanging around waiting for the tanker to come. It makes sure that everybody knows that the water is there a certain amount and they're going to get it for sure. And they can get it any time. They don't have to kind of jostle in line for water. They can go and get it when they need it. So it takes a lot of the pain out of it, and it kind of uses a flexible mechanism where you haven't put in this piped infrastructure, but you're still kind of allowing people to get enough water. The next piece is the groundwater piece. A lot of Indian households have Indian cities have been promoting artificial recharge through rainwater harvesting, where they've been encouraging buildings to kind of collect rainwater and pump it through into an abandoned borewell or a large infiltration pit. And that's kind of done, I think, reasonably well in terms of encouraging groundwater levels, in terms of improving groundwater levels in cities. Another innovative way to do it is to get around that legal problem with groundwater by telling households, we're not charging you for groundwater. What we are charging you is for the sewage that you're generating from the groundwater. And that's one of the things that's been tried out in Bangalore, which I think is one of the few ways to control urban groundwater, which by saying we're not controlling the groundwater, but we're going to measure or monitor the amount of sewage or just charge you a flat rate. But it makes people conscious that groundwater use is also water use. And the last piece of it is the sanitation and sewage piece, which is a big trend that you're seeing in a lot of Indian cities, which is to start thinking about treated wastewater as being wastewater as not being wastewater, sewage as not being wastewater, but being a resource that can potentially be reused in some way. The first picture is from outskirts of Delhi, where treated wastewater is being kind of resold to some agricultural farmers, and it's a good way of kind of compensating farmers because agriculture doesn't need perfectly high-quality potable water. It does need the water to be treated to some quality, but it doesn't have to be perfectly treated. And so there is some potential to do that. And increasingly, as the picture on the right shows, you're seeing a lot of in-situ recycling, particularly in Indian cities where water is extremely scarce. It actually starts becoming, once water becomes scarce beyond a certain point, it becomes viable to start recycling the water and using it in situ, either at the community scale or even at just an individual apartment complex scale. So to summarize all of those things that I talked about, Indian cities have big challenges, but I think that there are some solutions, but they do require a change of mindset or a paradigm shift before they're going to happen. Firstly, you need utilities and policymakers to be thinking about demand instead of supply-only approaches. They need to be thinking of decentralized sources and not just centralized sources of getting one water from one distant source. They need to be thinking of soft options, which is looking at, you know, those customer service responsiveness options, economic incentives, spot markets for water, versus, you know, we have to build three more sumps and six more pipelines. They need to be thinking of the informal sector, particularly in those settlements which I mentioned were not regularized. They need to be including institutions and governance issues versus focusing only on infrastructure, as engineers like to do. And they need to be thinking more and more as sewage as being a resource that can be used back by the city or to serve peri-urban agricultural communities instead of sewage as wastewater that's going to land up in a river and make everyone sick. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions. I can stay there.
Our thanks to Veena for her comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening and viewing audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. Pipe Dreams, Water for Thirsty Cities in India, with Veena Srinivasan. Now we open the floor to a Q&A. We have two standing microphones, and if you have questions, would you please line up behind the microphone and make sure to speak into the microphone. Any questions? Or would you rather us to pass around the microphone? Question?
Hi, Veena. That was very enlightening. I come from the same city as you do, Chennai. And I know that about 4 or 5 years ago, the government made it mandatory to collect rainwater in each household, because my mom put up a rainwater harvesting system. But I don't see that having lessened the problem of water, because I still see my mother still buys water. She gets it from the in these tankers. And her neighbors too face the same problem, even though they installed this. Why did that happen? Can you say
it? It really, the answer depends on which part of Chennai do they live in, actually. So Chennai is a coastal city, and the particular neighborhood that she talked about has a lot of seawater intrusion problems. So, and particularly south of that, there is a big saltwater wetland, which is the Pallikarnai Marsh, particularly then the southern part of it. So that rainwater solution doesn't always work in every part of it, because in some cases, the water is just too saline to be used. I don't know whether it was because the ground they dug a well and the well ran dry, or whether they dug a well and the well was salty. But clearly, there are parts of India where the groundwater can't be used, and the only solution then is to get better pipe supply. Chennai's case, like I said, there's all of those other problems why pipe supply doesn't work. It's the reservoir storage is inadequate, pipe supply is leaky, they don't have metering. They don't have any kind of control over groundwater. And so all of those pieces, the other pieces don't work. And so rainwater harvesting, it's a good point to make, doesn't work in every single place. Like I mentioned, in some places the aquifer is not suitable. In some places the aquifer is saline. And so groundwater as a backup source is not going to work either. So, yeah, so none of those solutions I pointed to are going to work every time and everywhere. But they are all pieces that need to be addressed in order for the whole system to work better. Yes. Thank you, though.
Thank you. Several years back, I read a little book by Rundi Roy against all these huge dam projects and moving from this river to that river and all. And I never saw anything about how all that came out. What is the result? Is there huge transfers from one river basin to another? Did any of that happen?
There hasn't been. It hasn't come to fruition, but the plans haven't gone away either. So it's kind of an ongoing tussle between the government, which feels that you ought to be doing it, and environmentalists without a pushing back. And I think that one of the pieces is engineers like to build large dams, and that's why I kind of emphasized at the end of my talk that if you look at it from every city needs a certain amount of water and it has to come from a centralized source, it's going to logically lead you to that conclusion. But if you started off with a starting point of what's the best way we can get water to meet the services that people really care about, you're actually going to lead to a different solution. And so I think that that's a problem. There's still a lobby that wants it. I don't think I'm one of the people that are going to be recommending that, given that I think there are all these other governance and demand and soft solutions that ought to be considered first.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Veena, that was really a good presentation. I grew up in Delhi, and I've been here for 20 years in the U.S. now, and I work for the federal government, EPA. And I go to India every year now, to Delhi. I think one point I've noticed is Indian cities, they grow organically. It's not a planning. So even if you think about or compare it to the Western cities or the, you know, the developed countries, it's very different mindset, the thinking how the cities are put together and how they function together, right? So I think that's one piece of the biggest piece is the planning. How do we go about and how do we address that? And in Delhi, what I've noticed in the last few years, the electricity, when I was growing up, it was the same supply-demand problem. You'll have electricity for 6 hours, then 10 hours there's no electricity. But from last few years, since they privatized it, so the low-level equilibrium, that's broken now. People expect service, and they're paying for it. So now if there's a power outage, you call, and within an hour, they have a service agreement to come back to you. So it is changing that, but I don't know how the water... I know water is still the government, so...
Well, the Sonia VR project I talked about is actually a privately run system for one piece of it. With electricity is a little different for water. Apart from the equity issues of, you know, what happens when people can't pay for it. With water, with electricity, you can go and build a power plant. There's not strict natural constraints on the quantity of water. With water, it really tends to be a zero-sum game because if you have to have more water for place X, it's got to be taken away from place Y, which isn't true of electricity. So the Sonia Vihar case, which I showed you, is a private distribution firm. So they've fixed pieces of the problem where they've started charging for it. They offer better service. But their agreement says that they can only do that if the Delhi Jal Board, that's the Delhi government, gives them the water in the first place. And the Delhi Jal Board, like I said, has no control over the water because it comes upstream from a different state. So there's certainly pieces of the problem that can have been attempted to be fixed, equity issues notwithstanding, but it's still water still ends up being this challenge because of the zero-sum game where the water has to come from some place, you may or may not have control over it. Yeah.
When you look at the drought areas right now in the Middle East, for example, currently experiencing about 7 or 8 years of drought conditions, a panacea, which is may not be the best in the world as far as I'm concerned, but it's one that's being used extensively in Saudi Arabia and Israel and Libya and some degree in Egypt, is desalination. And I know the Institute has come down with a number of background documents on that. I'm just wondering if such a panacea is being looked at in India.
Yes, it is. There's the city of Chennai, which I did my dissertation research on, which has a contract to build a desalination plant. Desalination is very, 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 very expensive. So if you do a cost-benefit analysis for how much people are currently paying or willing to pay versus how much desalination costs, it's still a big, big gap there. So, I'm not going to take a stand on the energy costs and all of that right now, but I have to tell you that if you go out and build a bunch of desalination plants in these cities, you're going to bankrupt the utilities because desalination is about a dollar, let's be conservative, a dollar per cubic meter. And consumers are now paying 10 cents a cubic meter. And so unless that is fixed, and 10 cents is almost, or 20 cents is like the high end of the consumer groups. And unless you fix that, then you're not going to fix the desalination problem. And if you fix that, then you might actually lower your demand so you don't need the desalination. So I don't think desalination is the cheapest. I don't think it's the most effective solution, but it is being tried in places. Yeah.
You know, I was just wondering about the cost recovery dimension of utility-supplied water in Chennai. For example, in Bangalore, the total debt by the utility, the Bangalore Water Supply and Sewerage Board, as of March 2010, stood at $422 million. So can you talk about cost recovery for Chennai?
I don't know the number for every city, but... there isn't full cost recovery in most of these cities. Bangalore is actually, I was just looking at the tariffs the other day, is among the best cities in terms of how much the tariffs are. So if Bangalore is, you know, at 10, so 20 cents a cubic meter, and in most other Indian cities, you're talking about much less than that. So firstly, the best I can say is that most other cities are much worse than Bangalore is in terms of cost recovery. The political hurdle of being able to convince people that this is a service they need to be paying for, and particularly the wealthier segments, right? The good thing is when you have economic growth, that wealthiest segment of the population that can afford to pay keeps expanding. So that's a good thing. But it's not always followed that cities have had that. And I don't see enough rhetoric saying that the wealthier people need to be paying. So it doesn't exactly answer your question in terms of what is the cost recovery number, but I broadly would say Bangalore is better off than other cities where that's concerned. Yes.
Yes, Veena, thank you very much for the very clear and informative presentation. I wonder if you know about any research that's been done on the impact of high-speed pumps, the small, easily accessible, inexpensive high-speed pumps that are being sold all over India now. I had understood that there were a million of them sold there last year, and I know that you can find them on Amazon for about $250. And the problem is that they're pumping out groundwater faster than nature can replenish it.
Yeah.
So has there been any study on this, or is the government thinking they might actually step forward and regulate the sale of these pumps in any way?
I haven't seen any discussion about trying to regulate the sale of pumps. That's kind of an interesting subject. It would be hard for the government to do, I think, because it's fairly an easy, accessible technology. I think in some ways the governments don't want to regulate the sale of pumps because they can't guarantee that they can supply the water in the first place, and I think that would be a hard line for them to take. A lot of the pumps go to rural agriculture, and so but as I mentioned, you saw the levels of groundwater use in Indian cities. That's a big problem. I'm not sure regulating pumps is going to be the easiest way of doing it, but you know, generally the impact of groundwater use in Indian cities has been done by a few people. The studies showed two interesting things, that it's a little more complicated than I showed in the talk today. Where you have deep aquifers, what you're seeing is the aquifer levels just keep dropping because it's like a big bathtub that you're draining out. But in a lot of cities which don't have those deep aquifers, so they have kind of a very shallow or hard rock aquifer, what happens is that in a bad year, the entire aquifer just drains out, and then it refills in a wet year. And so what happens is it has the effect of making variability even worse. So it's kind of a whole bunch of different. The impact of pumping, groundwater pumping, kind of is very differential depending on what kind of groundwater you have. Does that answer your question?
Yes, close enough. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Oh.
Hi, Veena. Along the lines of her question, can you talk a little bit about the groundwater bill and water policy and water schemes and how mining corporations are actually using a lot of groundwater and how that's largely unregulated?
Yeah. Everybody's using a lot of groundwater, which is largely unregulated. So I don't have an answer about how groundwater regulation schemes have been functioning, because there are a lot of groundwater regulation schemes, but when I've actually gone to look at enforcement, I see no enforcement at all. And some of that is by design, in the sense that let's take Chennai, where I've done most of my work. On the books, there is a very elaborate groundwater regulation scheme which says all sorts of things. You know, you can't dig a ground if you're an industry larger than a certain amount. Larger than a certain size, you can dig a groundwater well without permission. You need to pay a certain amount. But then you go and ask the question, well, that's a great bill, but who's enforcing it? There's one guy sitting in one building in the entire city whose job it is to regulate every single groundwater regulation there is. So he has to enforce the rainwater harvesting law. He has to give information on rainwater harvesting. He has to monitor the wells. He has to regulate, do the groundwater regulation. And a score of other things. Now, is he doing any of those things? No. So if you ask him, well, there's this great bill, what do you do to enforce it? He's going to tell you, well, if somebody complains to me about too much groundwater being extracted, I will go out and take a look at it. Well, in the last 20 years since the bill was passed, did anybody ever complain to you? He'll say, well, in 1992, one guy complained about his brother pumping too much. So, you know, that's really the enforcement piece of it, right? Because there are a lot of bills on paper. They're not funded in terms of enforcement. And in a sense, it's a question of whose job is it just to enforce. So in a lot of urban cities, all water is considered to be the job of the utility. The water utility doesn't get any money from groundwater. So they have absolutely no interest in regulating groundwater whatsoever. For them, it's just one more guy they've got to hire. As far as they are concerned, he doesn't bring in any revenue. So that's the problem. I mean, and I'm speaking more about cities, not about mining, but, you know, that same issue applies everywhere. It's hard for the government to justify or show interest in putting teeth in enforcement agencies, which is really personnel salaries. They have to have a car to go out, you know, test the groundwater, go and fire the guy. Apart from the fact that that guy might be a politician's son, which is a whole other story. But just let's not worry about the corruption. Just the fact that he has to go out in a car and be paid a salary, there's no money to do it because there's no interest in doing it because the utility gets no money out of it. So, yeah, sorry to not give you a better answer, but groundwater governance is a thorny issue. It's not an easy one. Yeah.
Thank you, Veena. Chennai is also home, so I'm very delighted to come to this presentation. It was very depressing, but I was wondering I didn't know about this website. I'm going to go check it out now. But I was wondering, I also traveled to Orissa recently, where in the eastern part of the country, where to give you a context to my question, where a Korean mining company called POSCO is setting up shop and is trying to displace the people there, in addition to also targeting the water there because an industry needs water. So I was wondering, during the course of your research, if in Tamil Nadu state you found that urban consumption was also being affected by industrial demand for water, especially since there has been a lot of industrial growth. I'm not sure exactly how much in the state of Tamil Nadu, but I'm sure I was wondering if you could speak to that.
So the piece that, I mean, there's a lot of industry to the north of Chennai, right? And there is a lot of industrial pumping. You do see impacts and what hydrologists would call a cone of depression, where, you know, you kind of have just the water being sucked out and you have this kind of cone around the industrial area. So you do see that in drought years. So it is a problem. It's very variable. The answer to that is it's very variable. You do see industrial pumping being a problem. It affects cities in some areas. A much bigger problem is the water quality problem with industrial pumping. That, you know, oftentimes there's absolutely no regulation on the quality side. So that's almost as big a problem. The one thing I did see in Chennai, which is almost interesting, is when you have aquifers and geology that doesn't permit, you don't have a very deep aquifer. When you have an industry that tries to suck water out of it in those areas, the industry really gets limited very quickly by the aquifer. So the answer really depends on what the underlying geology is. There are certainly places where you see, and around Chennai you'll particularly see that, but in a lot of peninsular India, which is hard rock aquifer, you'll see that industries can't pump too much because they kind of hit the bottom of their well very quickly. They can go deeper and deeper, but they kind of have this cone of depression where they've sucked out all the water, but the water from the surrounding areas is not kind of rushing into the well fast enough, so they can't pump it fast enough. So there's kind of the answer to your question is like it depends. Yeah.
Thanks again, Veena. I'm a little bit curious when you mentioned the tankers that specifically are serving the customers who say can afford to have a space under their house or under an apartment building. You mentioned that oftentimes the quality of that water is questionable. I'd appreciate you talking just a little bit more about what the contaminants are, how aware those consumers are of those contaminants, and really specifically what they're doing to address those problems.
So the Pacific Institute just actually finished a big project in another Indian city where they did ask some of those questions. So yes, tanker water is generally, it's untreated water. It usually comes from wells outside the city. which means that what's in the tanker water depends on what gunk is in the water outside the city. I've seen tanker water which is smelly and it kind of smells like gasoline. There's tanker water that has industrial contaminants, and then there's just good old-fashioned salt. And consumers generally will take whatever they can get because they can't get any better, anything better. So I would say that on the whole, awareness levels beyond the taste and smell, you know, things that people can perceive, are very low. They haven't been, you know, I don't see a lot of people going and trying to test it. And this was an issue that came up with surveys over and over again. We wish there were ways we could tell what's in the water. But I don't see any attempts to regulate it or too much effort being put in that direction. And I think part of the reason is people think, well, you're wealthy enough to buy a tanker, you can figure this out on your own, you know. There is a little bit of that. So there's not a lot of government excitement to try and do something about it.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question, so please.
Yeah, anybody else?
I can. Anybody else?
I already asked.
Who has the burning question?
I can ask.
Okay.
So, Veena, from the Institute's perspective, what can we do as the private citizens, or I work for the government too, because I think it's a governance issue, and we have similar issues in U.S. too. States fight for the Colorado water. We have groundwater depletion in the Central Valley, where all the irrigation is happening. So we deal with the similar issue. But in California, citizens are more concerned. They're more informed about it. So as a private citizen, people stand up. So what role the Institute is playing to build up these NGOs, NPOs, or think tanks to even create that awareness in just not India, all the developing countries or Africa, wherever the issues are?
You mean the Pacific Institute specifically? As I said, the Pacific Institute has a whole bunch of... So the one of the things, there's a lot of interest in kind of focusing on this transparency issue, right? This issue that if you empower people with information, you can't go and solve the governance issue in every part of the world, but if you empower people with information, they are better educated, they're better able to go and then negotiate with their own lawmakers. So there's a whole range of tools that the Pacific Institute has tried to invest in and try to develop, which involve these information and empowerment tools. So one of them is called the Water and Sanitation Hygiene Choices Tool, washchoices.org, which kind of offers people in developing countries a suite of point-of-use treatment solutions, saying if you lived in a certain area with a certain type of quality problem or a certain type of soil, what's kind of the best choice for you to go and do it? There's other things that we like to partner with, which we don't have a partnership with Transparent Chennai, but that type of organization within the U.S., which kind of tries to collate information, put it in an accessible fashion so it can be used by local citizens. That's another type of thing we would be interested in doing. Any type of visualization tool which kind of helps people walk through. I mean, Pacific Institute has a whole range of this. One is a water energy tool. One's an air quality tool, which kind of people can use to inform themselves. So I think just this idea of democratizing information and making it accessible is a role that can be played by institutes like the Pacific Institute, but clearly there are others that do that as well. Thank you so much for your questions.
Our thanks to Veena for her comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening and viewing this program. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th Enlightened Discussion, is adjourned.